Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening this week. We have three senior Army leaders with us this week to talk about how the Army is trying to accelerate the process of getting new tools into the hands of its cyber protection teams. In the Army's first ever Cyber Innovation Challenge, the service sought out non-traditional vendors who could offer prototype versions of toolkits to the cyber protection teams it deploys around the world to defend Army networks. Our guests this week are Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army's System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate, Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, and Ron Pontius, the top civilian leader at Army Cyber Command. We'll talk about the lessons the Army learned from its first innovation challenge. General Fogarty starts us off with an outline of that challenge for the Deployable Defensive Cyberspace Operations Infrastructure, DDI is the acronym.
DDI is the Deployable Defensive Cyberspace Operations Infrastructure, and that requirement is really meant to address the need for cyber mission forces to be able to outmaneuver the adversary in a designated network via on-site connectivity. And what it will allow our forces to do is conduct survey, secure, and protect missions. Now, this capability allows for those cyber forces to provide quick reaction, reinforcement, or security enhancement. And I'll let Mr. Wiltsey and Mr. Pontius discuss more in reference what was purchased. I just want to mention that the nano and micro cloud technologies we're procuring, they'll go a long ways toward enabling defensive cyberspace operations forces to employ their warfighting platform in a way that's adequately tailored to each mission and threat. Now, ultimately, the DDI will be utilized by service, joint, and national cyber protection teams to provide defensive effects in cyberspace from the strategic level down to the tactical level. And they'll be utilizing a capability that enables mission protection, discovery and counter-infiltration, cyberspace support, cyberspace readiness, and threat emulation.
And General, maybe you can talk a bit about the actual deployment function of the CPTs. I think a lot of people imagine cyber warriors being in fixed locations to do their job. When they deploy, what do they do?
Yeah, so actually I would defer that if Ron wants to pick that up as representing the operational forces. And if not, then I can certainly discuss that. But Ron, your thoughts?
Right. So this defensive cyberspace operations infrastructure, we've got three versions of it that we talk about. We talk specifically with this challenge. We were, as General Fogarty talked about, the deployable defensive cyberspace operation infrastructure. Again, that's deployable micro clouds used by the forces to deploy platforms and tools in order to defend the networks from the cyber threats. So that's really our maneuver force. We also have two other variations as we talk about this defensive cyberspace operations infrastructure. We also have the garrison version, which we call GDI. And again, this is pre-positioned microclouds on our unclassified and classified networks and are used by the forces to deploy the platforms and tools to defend the garrison networks from the cyber threats. And then we have what we call the tactical, again, defensive cyberspace operations infrastructure, or TDI. And this is, again, the micro clouds on the unclassified and classified networks in order to defend the tactical networks from the cyber threat. So we're really working three variations. This specific cyber challenge focused on the deployable as the first instantiation of this capability. Mm-hmm. And it's all being deployed or fielded to our cyber protection teams, which are the teams that the Department of Defense is standing up to be part of our overall cyber mission force to conduct defensive cyberspace operations, which is about defending our networks, data, and systems.
One more technical question before we move on. A lot of people probably have not heard the terms microcloud and nanocloud. And in relation to the large cloud instantiations that most people think of, describe what nanoclouds and microclouds are. Mr. Wiltsey, you want to take that one?
So from a technology standpoint, microclouds are really using portable servers that have both processing and storage capability on them. They're a typical 3U design. They're a 24 rack or a 12 or an 8, but they're very, very small. And so when the CPTs arrive, they'll have everything loaded on the devices. They can plug into the network, create themselves as a node on the network, and then do their operations. And that's really what the DDI is, and the micro technology being used is really kind of 3U design.
And I guess related to that, of course, is where we're virtualization is a very strong component of this also, where we have the various applications or tools that are virtualized instantiation, so we can spin up, spin down based upon what the specific need is in this micro cloud environment. So it gives us tremendous flexibility and agility in putting capability on mission specifically against a specific threat.
Have these DDI teams actually deployed? I mean, is this a future concept, or are they actually going out and helping combatant commanders in particular cyber hotspots today?
So clarify, it's the cyber protection teams are the organizational effort.
Yes, I'm sorry.
DDI is the equipping capability that we're giving to the cyber protection teams to do their mission.
Right.
So yes, the Department of Defense, we're in the fourth and final year of a four-year build of building the cyber mission forces. For the Army, we're fielding a total of 41 of these teams. There's five different types of teams, of which a subset is the cyber protection teams of the overall capability the Department of Defense will have. And as we have built the teams to initial operational capability and full operational capability, then the teams are being put on mission. So yes, we are absolutely using our cyber protection teams right now to defend Army and joint networks. And so this is part of enhancing their capabilities by giving them additional equipment on the DDI.
Got it. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the actual acquisition process. And this is probably for you, Mr. Wiltsy. Maybe you can take us through actually what the concept behind a cyber innovation challenge is, and then why the DDI requirement made sense for that construct.
So the innovation challenge is part of a larger consortium. We've added this requirement to a larger consortium called the C5 consortium, and C5 is the Command and Control Communications and Computer Technology Consortium. It's been around for a while, works across DOD and other agencies, but its real key is that it runs an other transaction authority versus a contract that follows the federal acquisition regulation. So let me just talk about what an OTA is.
Yes, please.
So an OTA was designed to allow the departments, the federal departments, to use this kind of a capability to get to R&D technologies that are available in the commercial world. So typically, the government uses an OTA when they need to obtain leading edge R&D and prototyping from the commercial sources. And what we do in innovation challenge is exactly that. The award for DDI went to two companies. It went to Critical Stack and Parsons Corporation. That they're going to provide prototypes to us, a total of four, that we'll then hand over to Mr. Pontius's teams, and they will do an evaluation, an operational evaluation of that capability. Helps us then determine what the final requirement will be, or what the next version of the requirement would be, because it will always be iterative. And then we'll use a more standard process to do contracting. But the consortium has a large number of non-traditional defense contractors in there, and it allows us to get to very small companies, allows us to get to very IT-focused companies, and allows us to then touch technologies that normally we would not get to from the formal process.
And as far as, you know, if you're after non-traditional vendors, you know, as opposed to sending out a notice and FedBizOps, how do you actually communicate that requirement to people who maybe are not part of among the usual suspects in federal contracting?
So what we do is officially we're communicating the requirement through the C5 consortium, which is made up of members of both industry, academia, and government. And the consortium will then push it out to their members. They'll give us white papers that we'll evaluate. We'll have a lot of discussions with them and then make a decision on which proposal we want to execute.
And one of the benefits of this is there can be more dialogue between the government entity that's has the emerging requirement and the potential vendors, the non-traditional vendors who want to make proposals, and then once they do, to better understand their proposals. Because again, we're getting at a limited number of prototypes, and so that dialogue and discussion is very, very important.
And Mr. Pontius, you want to talk a little bit more about what actually happens during this evaluation process? I mean, does it go through an NIE-like construct, something more formalized like that, or does it literally just go to a few CPTs and you get informal feedback from them?
So there's the evaluation process of the proposals, which lead to the actual awarding of that, and that's where we were having the dialogue and discussion. For this first challenge that we kicked off in May of 2015, and the kits, the final kits are being delivered this March, so roughly 9 months for the whole process, and that's pretty fast for the Department of Defense. But we're able to have that dialogue. We had originally planned on just awarding one proposal, but actually in the dialogue and discussion, we saw a benefit of doing a combination of both the Critical Stack and the Parsons, and had those two vendors work together on delivering a capability. So now when the capability will be delivered to the Army Cyber Command, and specifically to the cyber protection team, we will use that capability in training and actual deployments, and then give feedback both as General Fogarty talked about, give feedback to maturing the requirement for the more enduring capability of what's the next increment, and additionally give feedback on the acquisition side of the use of this kind of technology and what it really means. So we give some formal feedback of how well this was able to improve operations, how we were able to do, was it easy enough to be trained on, sometimes technology can be complicated, and so part of what you're trying to do is how easy can the users use it and support operation, again, given that agility and flexibility we need to do in this mission space.
Yeah, and on the topic, go ahead, General Fogarty.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Mr. Pontius pointed out is that, you know, by partnering with both traditional and non-traditional vendors, we really open the aperture. And in some cases, you know, we're going to find a capability that a non-traditional vendor provides. And if they're willing to work with other vendors, then it really becomes a win-win for both them and us.
That's Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence. Also talking with us this week are Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at U.S. Army Cyber Command, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. Quick break, and we'll come back and talk more about the Army's first cyber innovation challenge. This is on DoD, on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. This is on DoD. Getting back to our conversation with three senior Army leaders about the first cyber innovation challenge that the Army just wrapped up, using other transaction authority to award work to two vendors who will build prototype deployable toolkits for the Army's cyber protection teams. Our guests are Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at U.S. Cyber Command, also Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. Mr. Wilson, you mentioned, I think, that once you've got a final requirement, you sort of pivot to a more traditional FAR-based acquisition. But that requirement's obviously going to change over time, right? So maybe talk a little bit about how you stay agile in that process and make sure you're constantly updating these kits with the latest technology that you need as it becomes available once you're into that FAR procurement mode.
So there's a couple of points, and I'd ask General Fogarty to really talk about, from a requirement standpoint, the concept called the IT box, information technology box, which allows a requirement to define an end state, but allows us to incrementally apply additional capability as the system grows, and that's really what we would do here. So as we come out of the OTA and we've done prototyping, which allows us to not only determine whether the capability that the prototype provides is or isn't the requirement, and if not, what needs to be changed. It also helps Mr. Pontius and his teams on how they're going to employ it and the techniques and tactics and procedures they're going to use in the operations, and it helps General Fogarty in the requirement. And so what because we're using an IT box, what it allows us to do is between the three organizations have discussions and come to agreements on this is the capability that we can provide in a certain time frame, then an additional capability, an additional time frame allows us incrementally do it. It allows us the flexibility with inside of the end state requirement. It allows us the flexibility if something changes from the operational side or the requirement side that we can insert that into the requirement process and the acquisition process to make those changes. And I'd ask General Ferrer if he had anything he wanted to add about IT box.
Yeah, please, General.
Yeah, I think as Mr. Wilson said, we've really just started leveraging the IT box methodology, and what that allows us to do is go out, receive joint validation of the initial required capabilities, and then it will delegate the authority to approve follow-on requirements to the Army as long as those requirements are within the scope of the initial document. So as you're very aware of, changes in cyber take place at a very fast pace. And so this, we believe, gives us the flexibility that we require to stay ahead of the requirements and not be shooting behind the rabbit, basically. So another aspect of the IT box methodology is the creation of capability drop documents that enable spin-outs for tech refresh and upgrade. So once we deliver the capability, we know that the users, we know that the threat will evolve very rapidly to avoid our capabilities. And so the IT box methodology, you know, has that built-in flexibility. And we think these capability drop documents, they really take the place of operational needs statements in the future. So requirements aren't validated without the necessary funding already allocated.
And I think one of the things that's important to add in this space is technology is constantly evolving and the threat is constantly evolving. So we must have in place processes that, again, have that agility, flexibility, yet accountability for how do we actually equip our forces and evolve that forces. And then, so that's one aspect. Another aspect I really want to highlight with this challenge, and it's really in the larger, really a good news story, the basic idea for the capability that we had with this overall defensive cyberspace operations infrastructure, this is really an initial spin out of a DARPA project called Plan X. We're really embracing the idea of this open stack technology that's really being used heavily in industry. And so when you think about it, go to a bigger perspective, how do we really transition that forward-leaning, you know, technical research piece that DARPA's doing, and how do we transition that? And so this is a real positive story of how we, again, have that agility and flexibility and the innovation and leverage from the commercial industry.
Yeah, let's stay on that track if we can. Describe a little bit, if you can, what parts of Plan X you've been able to leverage and the DARPA work that has gone into this effort so far.
This is the piece so far that we've actually leveraged. Although DARPA is now starting to put some more of their capability in our periodic exercises, our cyber flags and our cyber guard exercises, where we're actually training, putting our cyber mission force teams in a training scenario, in an environment to do collective training. We're also experimenting with some of the emerging technology. And so our cyber flag from this past summer, DARPA was able to put initial instantiation of a larger Plan X capability. And as we go to the next cyber flag, there will be further iterations as Plan X further matures through the remainder of this year and throughout 2017.
Let me go back to IT Box for a minute, if I can. More broadly, beyond just the set of capabilities that we're talking about here, where does it make sense? I mean, does it make sense for all things cyber, and where else is the Army using it at the moment?
I'll take that one.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Pontius.
It is a absolutely good tool to be used, but it needs to be used in the right place, right time. It's not the right appropriate tool for doing a major weapon system like, you know, the main battle tank or the next iteration of Abrams or something like that. But it is more so, can be used in software intensive like a C2 sort, a command and control sort of program. But clearly the equipping of our cyber mission forces, that's a smaller scope, but it's got to have that be able to rapidly deliver. So that's a case where it's absolutely very applicable. It's not the IT box is not used widely in the Army. There are a couple instantiations, but it is used across in cases with some C2 and intelligence surveillance reconnaissance programs and some of the other services. But the Army has been extremely supportive of recognizing, again, we've got to be able to rapidly deliver the equipping capability to our cyber mission force as we're standing it up and putting these teams on mission.
That's Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at Army Cyber Command. Also with us, Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. We'll talk more about the Army's Cyber Innovation Challenge and other approaches the Army's taking to make cyber acquisition more agile after another quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbia. Talking this week with Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at Army Cyber Command, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate, about cyber acquisition and specifically the new prototype toolkits the Army just bought using other transaction authority via a non-traditional competition called the Army Cyber Innovation Challenge. Let's talk a bit more about the cyber challenge, and this was the first one that the Army's done, I believe, right? What do you think you learned from the first version, and
what lessons are you going to plow into future iterations, Mr. Wiltsey?
So there's another cyber challenge that we're putting together for March. We've already done one to look at situational awareness. The next one's continuous monitoring and analysis. And so there are areas as you expand defensive cyber operations to look at all of the elements that the cyber force has to do. This is a great area to look at what is the latest technology that's available out there and what capability does it bring. And so there's a few. I think you're asking the question, though, is could you use something like a cyber, like innovative challenge for other types of equipment in the Army? And the answer is it has its place. It allows us to do prototyping because that's really what it's focused on, helps us to get both feedback from a requirement standpoint and an employment standpoint. to better understand what we need to buy. And so there are probably other areas in the acquisition community where we should look at something along this lines. If you remember where when I described what the C5 consortium stood for, it was really about C2 and comms and computers, and so it was already in that space where you would want to use an OTA and a consortium to try and get to the leading edge technologies for things like radios, for things like command and control, and the ability to do big data analytics.
And I would add to it, the other, again, highlight of the challenges in the OTA is the emphasis about getting access to non-traditional sort of contractors. The critical stack company is a very small business, less than 10 employees when we receive their proposal. They would traditionally never be part, rarely would be part of these sort of things in the traditional sort of acquisition process. So it's very important to be able with these challenges to get at the non-traditional. So I would say not so much a lesson learned, but what will happen over time as the greater industry understands what we're doing with these challenges, more and more companies, especially non-traditional companies, will join the consortium and be able to make proposals on the way ahead. And that's why we're looking to have to do our third challenge, as Mr. Wiltsey referred to in March. We're looking to actually do that out in the Silicon Valley area, again, to expose what we're doing on a wider basis, not just, so to speak, the East Coast kind of guys that we've been seeing more of.
And on the OTA authority, unless I'm misunderstanding, I think if you use it, you basically have to do business with a non-traditional vendor. You can't do business with a traditional defense company with that authority. Correct me if I'm wrong. Feel free, please. But are the sorts of restrictions that you're under when you're using OTA too constraining for some things?
So let me answer the first question first. As far as I know, an OTA is not limited to a non-traditional defense contractor. It can be anyone. Its real focus is about trying to get to the leading edge R&D that's out there that's provided by commercial sources, and what you're doing is prototyping. You're not going into production, you're going into prototyping. And so those are really the boundaries of what an OTA is. It can be awarded to, in fact, I know of one years ago that was awarded to a very large defense contractor. And so unless the rules have changed, I don't know that it's limited. But really what it's focused on is trying to get to cutting edge stuff. And to get to cutting edge stuff, you tend to go to non-traditional defense contractors. The OTA is much simpler than the FAR and all of the reports that have to be done in order to be compliant with the FAR. And so you will get to those folks using an OTA. But its real focus is leading edge technology and prototyping is really the key words.
And I just want to add, there's two types of OTA. There's research and development, and there's prototyping. So what we did with the first challenge clearly was prototyping. But I could also see that their potential is could be a research and development based OTA that is geared towards conceptually how to use some capability, not so much about a prototyping, but how would that improve operations. I could see that also happening.
So we've talked about OTA, we've talked about IT box, regardless of the method that you're using. I mean, speed and agility, as we've kind of alluded to, are always going to be critical when you're buying cyber capabilities. What are some of the other approaches beyond those two things, if there are other things that you're pursuing to stay ahead of technology or at least keep pace with technology from an acquisition process standpoint? General Fogarty, you want to start us off on that?
So I think there's two ways that I can discuss, and so two other approaches. One is the rapid equipping force, and the REF has deployed tremendous capability very quickly to meet operational requirements. The force deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it really exists to equip those units that have operational challenges with near-term solutions. And so as the REF transitions over to Training and Doctrine Command, and it seeks to become more involved with meeting near-term cyberspace requirement, it'll allow us, I think, through proofs of concept, identify those requirements from the operational force, in this case, our cyber. We had a meeting today with the J6 from UCOM, and there's emerging requirements coming from that direction. We think there's potential to use REF in the future. And then there's also a development operations framework to conduct material development like functions that are prioritized by our cyber based on rapidly changing mission requirements. And DevOps breaks that long development, test, simulate, assess, field portion of the development process, creates a much tighter loop of events that produces smaller increments of capability. So an example would be code. Do you require the same process? Do you require the same documentation to write a particular cyber tool, whether it's defensive or offensive, that you would use to build an attack helicopter or a main battle tank? Yeah, I'd argue that you don't require that documentation. You certainly can't live with the protracted traditional development cycle. So these are two of the things that we're looking at as we move into the future. So one of the things as we've reorganized from the Signal Center of Excellence into the Cyber Center of Excellence, we recognize immediately that we had to take a look at the Signal Battle Lab and move it to become the Cyber Battle Lab. So one of the first efforts we made was develop an exercise series called CyberQuest that we've actually been able to work with real customers with real problems and use a very unique infrastructure that exists here at Fort Gordon. And so what that's really allowed us to do is learn lessons very, very quickly, and it's also allowed us to unite our cyber actual real teams with real combat forces in the field. If you take a step back and you look at the work that our cyber's really led for the support, cyber support to core and below, that's actually taking actual cyber teams that are part of the cyber mission force, both offensive and defensive, and linking those up with brigade combat teams in very realistic training scenarios at the Joint Readiness Training Center and then most recently at the National Training Center. And it is truly a partnership between our cyber, the Cyber Center of Excellence, the partner unit, and it starts with training the unit before they deploy to the exercise. It's actually providing real operators to augment those units. It's actually building infrastructure at the combat training centers to replicate a realistic threat. And then just as the traditional forces operating on the ground have to slug it out with an opposing force, our cyber operators are slugging it out with the world-class Cyber Op 4. And they do so in a very realistic environment that's absolutely matched to the combat commander's decisions and his battle space. So it really reinforces this theme that, you know, cyber, we don't do cyber for cyberspace. We utilize cyber as a form of maneuver to create the effects that a combat commander can actually use to achieve his objectives. And as you can imagine, very complex operations. We've learned a significant amount of lessons learned from these experiences, you know, in a real training environment.
That's interesting. And let's stick with the training piece for a second, because Secretary Carter mentioned that the 17 budget's going to include more money to construct more cyber ranges. Can you contrast a little bit what happens on a quote-unquote cyber range versus what you were just describing, General, at the core and below level at the CTC and the NTC?
Well, it can cyber range can actually be part of that that live environment. So if you think about a virtual environment that's actually compared with connected to a live training environment, you get the benefit and really risk reduction of a simulation that's paired with actual soldiers moving on the ground. And the good news is, you know, the Army's been doing this for a very long time. We're actually very capable. In this case, we actually had the ability to put cyber planners and integrators, you know, on a brigade staff, and then they get to plan effects that are completely integrated into a brigade commander's concept of the operations. And then these same forces then actually deliver those effects, or they're connected to other cyber forces that may be up echelon, so at a higher level, to request that support. And then the effect is actually delivered. And then the maneuver elements on the ground, they can see actually tangible effects from the use of cyber, either defensively or offensively.
That's Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence. Also with us, Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at U.S. Army Cyber Command, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. One last break, and when we come back, we'll step back and talk about some of the Army's most pressing cyber requirements on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Surdy. This is On DoD. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. As we finish up the hour on the Army Cyber Innovation Challenge, talking with Major General Stephen Fogarty, the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at U.S. Army Cyber Command, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. In our last couple minutes, let me finish up with two kind of related questions. One is, you know, and this is a big question, but what are some of the Army's sort of most urgent cyber requirements at the moment? And then of those, which one of those would make good candidates to feed into future cyber innovation challenges?
So I'll start and I'll go with the really immediate requirements I think would be a good candidate for future innovation challenges. And really, our near-term requirement strategy is focused on equipping the cyber protection teams. And I've just talked about, and Mr. Pontius has also, that you know, these teams are actually being employed operationally today. And then we've also trained those teams, and part of those teams have actually deployed to the combat training centers that I've talked about to provide that that tactical support. So that's very important. We've also additionally focused on ensuring we meet the commander's cyberspace situational awareness needs, and we're actually writing the requirement and the documentation to capture that now. So those areas continue to be capabilities we seek, and I think they are actually great candidates for integration into future innovation challenges.
Yeah, and I would add, too, with on the latter one, on the cyber situational awareness, and that's not just defensive cyberspace operations, but it's also in operating and defending our networks, what we call Department of Defense Information Network Operations, or DoDIN operations. And critical component of this is to be able to see ourselves. All the assets on the network, their configuration, their patch status, what kind of traffic is flowing on the network, because that not only enables you to be able to operate and defend your network unto itself, but you also are able to identify anomalous behavior. You know, something's connecting somewhere that isn't normally there, or traffic is flowing in outside the network that isn't normally there. So this cyber situational awareness is a key component, not only of defensive cyberspace operations, but also of DoDIN operations, to be able to see ourselves.
That sounds like a big network problem. And I think of, you know, solving problems like that through large programs of record like JRSS. Traditionally, the DoD has not solved big challenges like that with small prototype procurements, or am I thinking about this wrong?
Well, there's different elements. I do agree the larger sort of the DoDIN network and the data and the systems there, you could you could say, lend itself to a larger, potentially a larger program of record. But to then bring in innovation specifically about being able to see endpoint management, endpoint security, and you quickly get into big data analytics, what we're calling cyber analytics, because there's a lot of, you know, every server, every endpoint is of itself could be a sensor, and so there's a lot of data flowing. And how are you finding that needle in the haystack, so to speak, about what is that normal behavior versus anomalous behavior, right? And so this really lends itself in many ways to innovation, particularly on the cyber analytics piece.
Yeah, I would add to that remember, we're using OTAs for prototyping and to help us both understand the requirement and understand how we're going to employ it. And I think these innovative challenges really help, if it becomes a big program, helps define what capabilities we are available out there from the entire technology industry, because you can get to almost anyone through these consortiums, and it allows you to see and utilize those capabilities before you go out for a big program. So don't think about them as in competition. They really are in support of each other, and allows us to really hone what we need and when we need it.
And I think the other thing that we really have to be careful is to, you know, make sure we clearly understand the requirement. And so there will be multiple requirements really for cyberspace situational awareness, I think, depending on where you sit. So is it a national decision maker, a combatant commander, a corps commander, or a brigade commander? And although there'll be certain elements that I think will be common across that entire audience. There are going to be some very unique ways that we'll have to visualize that information, so it's actually operationally relevant for a commander at a particular level, and it will assist him in making a decision, not in just confusing him. And so as we've worked this and discussed this at all levels, I think there's a clear understanding that, you know, this is a very demanding requirement, and our ability to use an innovation challenge to really understand what the art of the possible is, to refine what that requirement is, and then potentially lead us to potentially a very quick solution is going to be very important. So you think about the requirements driving the process. I think we can't lose sight of that. And I think what Mr. Pontius and Mr. Wolsey have worked very hard on behalf of our cyber and the ASALT is to deliver capabilities as rapidly as possible. And they've really explored and they're working some very innovative ways to get after these problems very, very quickly.
One additional point I'd like to make, although
we're
obviously all from the Army and we've been focusing on the Army, the nature of this space, though, is inherently joint. The Department of Defense is embracing and moving towards a single global joint network, and what it really means to operate in this space is, as I said, inherently joint. So we're also very collaborative with our other service cyber components and United States Cyber Command as we really evolve this space forward. We're sharing what each of us are doing. We're leveraging what others are doing so that the Department of Defense and the taxpayer is getting the best capability for the least cost and as we move this space forward. So I just do want to highlight the joint nature of the space we're working in and our commitment to that space.
And sorry, General, one more thing. To what extent does that drive you to joint requirements and validating that what you say is an Army requirement actually fits into this thing called JIE that we're all moving toward and that plays nicely with your sister services?
Well, I think exactly as Mr. Pontius really indicated, that this is a very collaborative space. And I think the processes that U.S. Cyber Command have set up, you know, actually encourages sharing of capabilities. If you think about it, each service has approached this a little differently. And I think as we evolve, really our understanding. There are certain practices that will prove best practices from other services that that we'll adopt. I think we'll see that in tools and techniques, tactics, and procedures in organizations. So I'm actually very excited where we're at today. We have a long ways to go, but we've actually come a long ways. There's certainly a lot more to learn, but I think if we can evolve as much faster than the threat, then that's going to really put ourselves in the best position of advantage.
Major General Stephen Fogarty is the commander of the Army Cyber Center of Excellence, one of three senior Army leaders who joined us this week to talk about the Army's new Cyber Innovation Challenge. Also with us were Ron Pontius, the deputy to the commanding general at U.S. Cyber Command, and Doug Wiltsey, the director of the Army System of Systems Engineering and Integration Directorate. We thank all three of them. We will post more information about the Cyber Innovation Challenge at federalnewsradio.com. And if you missed any of our conversation, we'll post this week's full show there as well. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks, as always, for joining us. I'm Jared Servio. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.